physical naturalism necessary for science or superfluous? And Don is a physicist professor at Covenant College in Lookout Mountain, Georgia. So, Don, go ahead and share with us.
Okay. I guess, as a physicist, I'd rather be in the multiverse section, but I'm glad that I'm allowed to agree with Gerald, because that means in some universe I'm actually over there listening to that and I'm talking here. But this is really my my statement that I had it on when I put it in. I don't know. All right. Well, I'm going to start with the goal. I want to approach the discussion from a different angle, perhaps a refreshing one. First, I want to give you a scientist's reaction, my own reaction to this issue a little bit, and then discuss the demarcation problem. Now, I did review that in Edinburgh, and I bet nobody was at my talk there 2 years ago. But how many of you are scientists? And how many of you have heard of the demarcation problem? So that's a smaller subset, but I expect more in this crowd than out there in general among scientists. But I think it is something we should be aware of. The notion of natural-supernatural dualism comes up. You'll see how. I want to mention another concept I'll introduce later. And then a new principle, what I call the Feynman integrity principle, that I think should help us along with this dilemma that we have to put up with all these people arguing about methodological naturalism if it's perhaps not all that helpful. And just a couple remarks at the end. First, my reaction. Okay, I read an article a short time ago that was published in Christian Scholars Review by McDonald and Tro, and they've convinced me that it makes sense for a philosopher to look at me and say, oh, you are pursuing methodological naturalism in your science. And I thought, well, that sounds okay. I'll let him look at me and they can philosophize about me. But when I hear someone saying that I must follow methodological naturalism to do my science, then I start to get suspicious. Okay. After all, when I'm working out some equations, I'm not thinking I've got to be methodological naturalist here. And I'm rather thinking, well, I got to be careful. I got to get this right. And I don't want to make mistakes. And I have to recheck it. And I have to make sure everything's okay. Or if I'm working at a lab bench, that's what my colleague does. I don't. I'm the theorist. But if I were working at a lab bench, as the abstract says, I'm rather thinking something along the lines of how the last time I ran this experiment, there was this problem and that problem, so I need to be careful and do this and not that, so I won't have the same issues come up and so on. Those are the kinds of things that are running through my head. What the question arises then, when somebody says I have to act methodologically naturally, what is the agenda behind it? Okay, maybe I've been reading too many postmodern books about this. You know, it's the power game and all that, which is probably true. But science, in some sense, is the last modernist discipline left. The scientists haven't heard of postmodernism, really, and we think we can still be objective and neutral, and we can, you know, agree on everything. And there is a little bit of a myth there, but never mind, that's not really what the talk is about. So a read of the literature uncovers several things people are trying to accomplish with the goal. It's simply true by definition, some people say. That's where the demarcation issue comes in. Some people try to use it to keep supernaturalism out of science. Maybe that's good in some sense. Some people try to keep certain kinds of supernaturalism out. Maybe somebody tries to use it to keep crackpots out. I just put that in there because we got to keep a lot of people out. So, you know, crackpots are good people to keep out. I didn't see anybody writing about that, actually. But we also, I read that we need to use it to limit science in order to make space for other ways of knowing. Now, that could be a reasonable approach. I'm not saying that there are no good uses for the idea, but I'm really asking the question, is it superfluous or is it necessary? All right, so what happened? Oh, okay. So what's the problem is here? These are the things that I mentioned. Now, in the first case, the problem is that it can't be true by definition because the demarcation problem, which is a philosophical problem about science, says that there is no definition of science that everyone will agree on, and so that can't be possible. Now, what about the supernatural? Well, I think there's also kind of a natural-supernatural demarcation problem. There are different ways of looking at that issue, but I want to give you an outline of why I think that's also a problem, so you can't really draw a line between the natural and the supernatural in a very real sense. And for these other three, well, my argument here is not that I want to argue them all down. It's mainly that science as a cultural enterprise actually does a pretty good job of those things if we just look at it as it's practiced. And so I want to outline that. So first, the demarcation problem. The idea is we want to define science. Now, there was a long history of this because back in the 19th century, moving into the 20th century, logical positivists who grew out of the Enlightenment wanted to have an objective, neutral method that would lead to truth. And so why is this important? Well, that's the reason it's important, because in those days, science was the new kid on the block who was going to lead us into all truth, and so we want to really know what we're doing. So we need to know when we have that objective universal knowledge, otherwise we won't know when we know, which is not good. Okay, so that means we also need to know how to reject knowledge claims, and we need to know how better to bash religion. Okay, that was really some of the motivation of some people. Not everybody, but that was part of it. Nowadays, it'd be nice to know what science is so we know what to teach, about science. Partly also because the courts act as if there is a definition. I'm sure you're familiar with some of the cases, but usually there is a definition, and sometimes officially so, like in the Arkansas case. The whole case turned on the definition of science. And Michael Ruse should have known better. He was the witness for the side that got that through. He's a philosopher. But, okay, what I'm doing here is just citing a paper by Larry Loudon in 1983, because I think it's the best summary of what happened over the course of the 20th century when they were trying to find a definition of science that would really work. And basically it ran into the postmodern problem. You can imagine, as Del Ratch says, I didn't put it on the slides, but he says, science has a bad case of the humans. You can't get the humans out of science. It's human enterprise. But Loudon in this paper says it's probably fair to say that there is no demarcation line between science and non-science or between science and pseudoscience which would win assent from a majority of philosophers. Okay, he's not talking about scientists. We just go our merry way, and we know what we do in the lab and so on. But philosophers tell us this. He also says the quest for the latter-day demarcation criterion involves an attempt to render explicit those shared but largely implicit sorting mechanisms whereby most of us can agree about paradigmatic cases of the scientific and non-scientific. Okay, that's philosophical jargon, but it means you just can't draw that line between the different cases. And so then he asked a question about necessary and sufficient conditions, because that's what you'd need for a definition of science. But he says if you only have a necessary condition, then it does not tell us that something is definitely a science. Okay, so you can look at physics, but you can't say it is in science. You might be able to say astrology is outside, something like that. And if you have only a sufficient condition, it doesn't tell you when something is not a science. So you've got to have both. The demarcation criteria, and they're still quoting Loudon, demarcation criteria are typically used as machines de guerre. You know what that means, machines of war, in a polemical battle between rival camps. He makes this observation, and I think it's referring to what I talked about at the beginning, creationists or ID versus you know, people supporting the standard science and so on. Indeed, many of those most closely associated with the demarcation issue have evidently had hidden and sometimes not so hidden agendas of various sorts. And that's how I feel when I raised the issue at the beginning. Why am I suspicious when I feel somebody putting me in a box as a scientist? But I also should mention here perhaps that Larry Loudon is not criticizing science in any way. He even says in his paper that the Arkansas trial came to what he believes to be the right conclusion, but for all the wrong reasons. So he's criticizing the philosophical argumentation here. So he goes on to say, but the value-loaded character of the term science and its cognates in our culture should make us realize that the labeling of a certain activity as scientific or unscientific has social and political ramifications which go well beyond the taxonomic task of sorting beliefs into two piles. Now, he didn't mention economic ramifications, but if you have something that doesn't look scientific and you send a proposal to the NSF, it's not going to get funded. So that would be important. But everyone knows that when you say that's not scientific, you're making a pejorative statement. So it really does have this connotation, and that's a big part of the problem. Okay, so the evident epistemic heterogeneity of the activities and beliefs customarily regarded as scientific should alert us to the probable futility of seeking an epistemic version of a demarcation criterion. All right, that speaks for itself. And since 1983, there have been a number of papers about this elaborating, but it's still pretty much the consensus among philosophers of science that there is no definition. So finally, if we would stand up and be counted on the side of reason, now these are strong terms, we ought to drop terms like pseudoscience and unscientific from our vocabulary. They're just hollow phrases which do only emotive work for us. I don't quite go that far, but that's interesting to see what he says. I think this is finally, I'm getting on. Insofar as our concern is to protect ourselves and our fellows from the cardinal sin of believing what we wish were so rather than what there is substantial evidence for, and surely that is what most forms of quackery come down to, then our focus should be squarely on the empirical and conceptual credentials for claims about the world. The scientific status of these claims is altogether irrelevant. Now, I'll get back to this later, but in a nutshell, he's saying we need to argue about the nitty-gritty, why you believe this and not some big picture thing. So the problem is related to the postmodern shift. The modernist hope lost its moorings somewhere in the way. And this scientific story that I'm outlining here is really part of that postmodern shift in the big picture, if you study any of the postmodern literature. So there's no sure method to get objective neutral truth from reason and experience alone is the conclusion. All right. Now, this is just a teaser heading towards Feynman later, but Richard Feynman, how many know who he is? He's a Nobel laureate, one of the best physicists of the century, last century. What is science? Well, he was talking to a group of educators, and he was told to give a talk on what is science. And he starts out, of course, you all must know if you teach it. That's common sense. What can I say? If you don't know, every teacher's edition of every textbook gives a complete discussion of the subject. He's getting a little bit sarcastic. There's some kind of distorted distillation and watered down and mixed up words of Francis Bacon from some centuries ago, words which then were supposed to be deep philosophy of science. And then he goes on to say, but one of the greatest experimental scientists of the time who was really doing something, William Harvey, said that what Bacon said science was the science that a Lord Chancellor would do. He spoke of making observations, but omitted the vital factor of judgment and what to observe and what to pay attention to, sort of those human things that the demarcation problem ran into. And so what science is not what the philosophers have said it is, and certainly not what the teacher editions say it is. What it is a problem which I set for myself after I said I would give this talk. So he's trying to figure it out, sort of, in the talk. Anyway, I won't go on to that, but I want to go on to the next issue, and that is the supernatural-natural dualism. Now, I have an advertisement here because I'm just going very quickly through the a historical story, but in this book that I wrote with Tim Morris, one of the chapters deals with this issue. So just wanted to point that out as available. This is starts out as a 12th century issue, and the reason I say this is we're kind of locked in the 21st century to a dualistic view of natural supernatural because we've been through the 19th century, and that's the story that I want to outline. But they started out by asking a very different question. Can God change the past? Now, this was not a superfluous question like angels dancing on the head of a pin. That's a caricature anyway of medievals. But this was related to an old, I think it was a 5th century issue that had to do with the siege of Rome and the rape of women and can God restore their virginity? You know, serious questions and very sad ones. But it becomes a philosophical question, and Anselm answered that God cannot be corrupted. God cannot make false what is true. So something that is already true, he can't rescind it because he can't go against his past will. But then there are few constraints, but otherwise God has absolute power. And so they formulated this in the framework of two powers, an absolute power and an ordained power. Those are the Latin terms that you see in textbooks. The absolute power is the power that God can do anything that's logically possible. He can't do things that aren't logically possible, but he can do anything that's logically possible, except maybe go against his nature. There are certain things which are moral, I guess, but they'd have to formulate. And the ordained power is that which actually God ordains to do. Now, here is a Venn diagram of these powers. The absolute power is everything possible. The ordained power is the realm of actuality. And laws and miracles are all in here. Right, those are things that God ordained according to his purposes. Now, there was some historical events that happened, the condemnation in 1277 in Paris that actually condemned certain principles of Aristotelian logic. Here's one of the arguments, just to give you an example. A vacuum is illogical. Why is a vacuum illogical? How many know that? Okay, well, it's because God cannot move the universe over and leave a vacuum. So therefore, God cannot create a vacuum. It's something along those lines. You know, it's something that doesn't make sense to us now, but it was. They viewed it as a limiting of God, and therefore that kind of principle was condemned. A number of Aristotelian principles associated with this, even ones that Thomas Aquinas held, were condemned at that time. It only lasted 3 years. It wasn't that bad. So Aquinas was restored, and he became the doctor again. But that's. But anyway. In the condemnation of God of 1277, the real point was that God cannot be limited by our logic. And that opened the door for God's free action in the universe. The real issue before had to do with, is God a necessary God? Well, I went too fast. Is God a necessary God? If he's necessary, perhaps creating the world that he creates, it's a necessary world, and there were questions about that. And that's how this whole issue arose. Now we have a God who is free to freely create, and everything he creates, the only way we can do it, learn about it, is studying it. We can't just think logically about it and figure it out. So we have to go study it. Now, okay, quick history, rise of modern science. There you have it, all the way up to Newton. But the point was, the issues of two powers was no longer a pressing issue, but the terminology was still around, and you begin to see people using it differently. And because of the rise of the modern physics, the mechanistic universe, the Newtonian laws, there became a focus on laws of nature as it had not been in the past. God's ordinary activity is thought of as the laws of nature, and miracles don't seem to fit in that category. And so people began to talk about, rather than potentia ordinata, the ordained power, they began to talk about potentia ordinarius, the ordinary power. And so in the meantime, the mechanistic philosophy saw great promise. Robert Boyle saw it as God's sovereign sustenance, and I think with some credence, and even saw it as a Christian view of science. But by the 19th century, the mechanistic universe had sort of run amok and no longer needed God anymore. The deism began to take over. And So in our terms, well, I don't know about forever because I don't know what the future is, but up until now, we're still kind of in this mechanistic thought process. So what happened was this. Venn diagrams, oops. And finally, the miracles are bumped out of the circle. And so now we have the ordinary power. I should have changed that. And then the miracles are another realm. So we have a tendency of dualistic thinking that we inherited partly because of our modern science. We tend to think of the world as a machine. Okay, quantum mechanics changed all that too, but that's not what we're seeing in most of our mindsets. And so God separated is separated from his sustaining work of creation. Creation works automatically like a machine. God is removed from creation, so we have deist habits of the mind. And when I ask my students that, they all say, yeah, yeah, that's how I think. And maybe scientists often do too, de facto. And I think that is a problem. Well, I have to summarize. If there's no dualism between God's action in the universe, and I'm arguing that the first view actually captures how God works, and we've seen other talks that corroborate that better than the dualist view, then we can't really draw a line between natural and supernatural. In some sense, the same working that God is doing in the universe through his laws is also the work that he does through his miracles, so-called, which are according to his purposes. So there are only regularities and possible deviations from those regularities, but both are being worked out according to God's purposes. Therefore, there's no clear category called natural for methodological naturalism to be limited to. It could merely be saying that science is only good at studying regularities, which maybe it is. Maybe that's what it's saying. But we're focusing on the regularities in our science. We call them laws of nature. That's almost a habit of the mind. I'm going to go really fast through this because it's almost superfluous, but I want to just say that when I use the term mere science, what I'm referring to is just science as it's done. Not defined, it's, you know, fuzzy boundaries, it's just a bunch of people working on their problems. And so if there's no definition, we're just back to that. So we have to ask, what is the cultural science? And we all agree on some things, you know. All us scientists, we're going to agree there is a world out there. Well, even there, you can be an anti-realist, you know, if you really want to get down to it. But there is a world out there. We're going to have some common convictions. I think you've probably seen these in other talks as well. There exist regularities. We trust our logic. Our senses are reliable. And we're going to have a common social network. We sort of build our social network by tutoring our students, teaching them how to do the science, and they learn as our apprentices. And there's also some kind of common ethic behind the scenes. And there are also differences. We don't have, obviously, we don't have a definition. We also have different worldviews, even though we're all working together. And so I have a picture of this. The different worldviews, of course, at different points can lead to different judgment calls about the meaning of the data. So here's a picture. Worldview tributaries running into a river. The constraints of nature that we do with our experience. Here we have the common convictions and the social culture, but as we get out to the delta, there are all kinds of different interpretations possible. So now I want to get to Feynman's suggestion about, in this context, how do we deal with what we have to do as scientists in order to have integrity in the science. Okay. All right, so now just a few quotes from Feynman. He's a very lively thinker, and I think you'll get that sense from the quotes. But he says, another of the qualities of science is that it teaches the value of rational thought, as well as the importance of freedom of thought, the positive results that come from doubting that the lessons are all true. You must here distinguish, especially in teaching, the science from the forms or procedures that are sometimes used in developing science. It's easy to say we write, experiment, and observe, and do this or that. You can copy that form exactly, but great religions are dissipated by following form without remembering the direct content of the teaching of the great leaders. In the same way, it's possible to follow form and call it science, but it is pseudoscience. See, he uses the term. In this way, we all suffer from the kind of tyranny we have today in the many institutions that have come under the influence of pseudoscientific advisors. He has some very nice examples of pseudoscience, which I didn't include. But he says, when someone says science teaches such and such, he's using the word incorrectly. Science doesn't teach it. Experience teaches it. If you say, if they say to you, science has shown such and such, you might ask, how does science show it? How did the scientists find out? How? What? Where? Not science has shown, but this experiment, this effect has shown. And you have as much right as anyone else upon hearing about the experiments, but we must listen to all the evidence, to judge whether a reusable conclusion has been arrived at. In a field which is so complicated that true science is not yet able to get anywhere, we have to rely on a kind of old-fashioned wisdom kind of definition, or a definite straightforwardness. I'm trying to inspire the teacher at the bottom to have some hope and some self-confidence in common sense and natural intelligences. The experts who are leading you may be wrong. So he's, you know, saying question, question, question. Then he says, we've heard a lot from experience about how to handle some of the ways we fool ourselves. He gives an example here, and I think I'll skip that for time, but it's an example where Millikan really got embarrassed by fooling himself. But now I come to what I call his integrity principle. He says, but there is one feature I notice that's generally missing in cargo cult science, which is really pseudoscience because he's the example from cargo cults. That's the idea that we all hope you've learned in studying science in school. We never explicitly say what this is, but just hope that you catch on by all the examples of scientific investigation. It's interesting, therefore, to bring it out now and speak of it explicitly. It's kind of a scientific integrity, a principle of scientific thought that corresponds to a kind of utter honesty, a kind of leaning over backwards. For example, if you're doing an experiment, you should report everything that you think might make it invalid, not only what you think is right about it, other causes that could possibly explain your results and things you thought that you've eliminated by some other experiment and how they worked to make sure the other fellow can tell they have been eliminated. Let's see. And I'm going to go right to the principle. This has a long history of learning how to not fool ourselves. Okay, this is really what I'm calling the principle of having utter scientific integrity is, I'm sorry to say, something that we haven't specifically... I think I got confused on my slides. I'm missing a slide. Okay. This is the private version. But the point here is that the first principle is that you must not fool yourself. That's the first principle. And you are the easiest person to fool, says Feynman. So you have to be very careful about that. After you've not fooled yourself, it's easy not to fool other scientists. You just have to be honest in a conventional way after that. So how do you not fool yourself? Then he likes to add a more public version, and he says that we scientists have to be very careful when talking in public not to fool the general public. And I think that's also something that we have to take seriously here. He says, I'm talking about a specific extra type of integrity that's not lying, but bending over backwards to show how you're maybe wrong that you ought to do when acting as a scientist, and this is our responsibility as scientists, certainly to other scientists, and I think to the layman. All right, so that's the principle. It implies that when there are disagreements, we should get down to the nitty gritty. We shouldn't be arguing from big frameworks. Where differences arise, we should be prepared to tell each other why we made certain judgments at every stage. Science doesn't become public until it can be convincingly shared. And there are levels of how public science is, depending on who can be convinced. You know, there are different communities. Better ways of communicating can bring more of the science into the more accepted category. And I'm about out of time. If the science cannot be publicly communicated, I would suggest that perhaps it's not so well-founded as we thought. And that could be one of the problems in some of our discussions. Maybe not. Maybe people are just willfully blind. But those are issues I think we should take. And I want to just bring these remarks concerning education, because I think that one of the issues is what we teach our students, maybe even high school. I hope little hope at present for the real solution, because I think teachers are not trained well enough at the undergraduate level. They can't make independent judgments, so they usually just take what they've learned factually and disseminate it. That's a real problem, I think. And also, they don't know the kinds of historical problems that go into all of these issues, because they haven't been taught that, because they've been taught, you know, their physics courses or their biology courses. So we have a problem in our high schools because we don't know how to prepare the teachers in order to address the issues there. So I would suggest that we shouldn't say scientists believe or scientists say, but maybe here's just an example thing we could be saying. Okay, we found this particular fossil in this stratum. Others have found lots of fossils in of this type in the same stratum, and there aren't any in other strata. And so we're pretty clear about that. Here's how we did the aging process, you know, and some nitty-gritty. And they'll, if they follow along, but we might rather tend to say scientists demonstrated that this is true. Or even worse, evolutionary theory tells us that this about this particular fossil. Those are kind of dead facts. And this is kind of bringing somebody into what is the process by which you learn the things that you claim to know. So that's basically it. I just have to put these bullets down. But the bottom line is, I think methodological naturalism is really more of a smokescreen when we're coming to the substantive issues, and we really need to get down into the nitty-gritty to unravel these issues to see why there are disagreements at the various points and how deep the disagreements go. And I'm really out of time.
Okay. Thank you, Don.
Can I have a question?
Let's have one question, and because of the shortness of time,
Who's?
Thank you. How would it change the way courts proceeded if they recognized the demarcation problem?
Well, first of all, they'd have to recognize if they recognize the problem, then they're going. Here's the big problem. The government has not discovered we're in a postmodern world, but there are good reasons that we're in a postmodern world. And until the government discovers that, none of this stuff in the schools that is happening in the courts is going to be addressed. And I once asked Eugenie Scott that question, and she insisted, no, science is not in the postmodern world. We have the objective certainty. And so when you have those kinds of differences, but the real issues that are philosophical behind the scenes are relative to judgment calls, you've got to resolve that problem where you're never going to make progress in the practical areas.
Okay, thank you.